Welcome to the next episode of Destination Biotech. I'm your host, Eric Hall, and I'm here today with my co-host.
I'm Matt Schaefer, the biotech student outreach intern.
And we're here today with our guest, associate professor in Ag and Biosystems Engineering, Dr. Adina Howe. Welcome.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
And also along with her is Nicole Gurdes, a first-year grad student in Dr. Howe's lab. Welcome.
It's great to be here today.
So we're really excited to have Adina and Nicole here with us. We've had really good relationships with the Howe Lab over the last few years, developing curriculum materials, hosting research experience for teachers as well. And we're excited to extend that now into the podcast world. So first, let's start off. Just tell us a little bit about your journey, how you ended up here at Iowa State doing what you're doing, so that everybody has an idea of what your path has been. So Adina, you want to start?
Sure. So I was an engineer by training. I thought I was going to become a mechanical engineer when I was an undergraduate. I liked tinkering. Back in graduate school, I had the opportunity to really think about what I wanted to do as far as helping the world. And at that point, this will date me quite a bit, that the word sustainability first became invented. Mm-hmm. And as a 21-year-old, I thought that was so cool. We're going to save the world. We're going to do something impactful around the environment. And it really drove me to move into environmental engineering, which is where I learned about microbiology and the role it could play in the environment as these invisible living creatures that are so important to our bodies, the environment, and how we're connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I really got interested in research. And then I really got interested in just working with people doing research, and that brought me into the academic space.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Nicole, how about you?
Yeah, so I grew up in Cedar Falls, and I did my undergrad at UNI. So I've always been in Iowa, and I guess the kind of questions that we're trying to ask and answer in Adina's lab are really impactful to Iowa and the Midwest, and so I think that's kind of why I find this type of research so interesting. Mm-hmm. And to like have a tangible impact on not only our generation but future generations is really important to me. I got involved in undergrad research, and then I just found myself in grad school a few years later, and I think that's how it usually happens.
And you didn't want to leave.
No.
So here you are.
She hasn't left yet.
No.
Right.
So
one of the questions that I always like to ask people has to do with where your mind was back in maybe late elementary, middle school, high school. That's who our audience is for these podcasts. So think back, if you can, to where you were during those years. And, I mean, did you see yourself ending up where you are now? Or what was your thought at that time? What did you want to do? How did you see your future kind of playing out?
First, my answer is so ridiculous, I should not go first. So.
Yeah, I guess for me, growing up, I think that I was always interested in just learning about anything, being able to find problems to solve and ask questions, always interested me. And then going, I guess, a step further into my like higher education career, I was a first-gen student, and so I didn't really see myself going into research. And so I actually didn't even know it was a possibility until I started doing it. And then I was like, wow, I could actually do that. So looking back on it, I can see, like, I guess, like a trail of crumbs, like, leading me to where I am now. But in the moment, I never would have thought that I would be here.
Sure, yeah. Doing this. Were there moments or individuals who maybe gave you that spark at some point? Or was it just you thinking, this is where I want to go?
Yeah, I think for me, it was probably my undergrad research advisor that was really like, you know, you're kind of good at this. Like, maybe you should think about, like, actually doing this. Mm-hmm. I had planned on going on to professional school, maybe thinking, like, genetic counseling or PT initially. Mm-hmm, so where I am now is definitely a lot different than where I thought I would be going. But yeah. I'm happy.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's the important part. So now, what's the other story, Adina?
Well, I went too far back. I was back in kindergarten.
It's only a 20-minute podcast.
Oh, sorry. So I wanted to be a fireman's dog. I thought that'd be super fun. But I was always pretty attracted to math and science. And so it was a a natural point for me to be recommended as a field for engineering. I really didn't know what it was, but then I got to the point where it was almost a competition, because at the time when I was in engineering school, there weren't many females in engineering. I think that's coming more balanced now. We still have a lot of work to do, but it was almost like, well, let's start this game then. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say I'm a competitive person by nature, but if confronted by a challenge, I'm not one to back off. So maybe people would disagree with the competitive part too. I'm not sure.
I don't know. You said yes to this, so I feel like that's probably true. Yeah. So let's jump into a little bit more about your research here, what it is that you two do. We've talked a little bit about water quality in past episodes. You're part of the same research group as some of our other guests, but we want to talk about what you do. And so just kind of a general idea of what your research projects look like, the kinds of questions that you're answering, and maybe a little bit about how you develop those questions along the way.
Right. So maybe broader than water quality, we really look at environmental quality and from soil to plants to water and how they're connected in our lives. And there's lots of reasons to study water quality. One is human health. I mean, we're drinking water, we play in water. So from the health side, we want to make sure it's clean. Another reason we study water and what's attached to water, whether it be soil or how we practice agriculture, for example, is because we want the environment to look nice, right? We're in Iowa. A lot of people enjoy recreation in the environment, and you want to enjoy what it looks like. If you came here hundreds of years ago, you'd experience a very different landscape. We've changed that landscape in a positive way in that we feed the world. I would argue we've changed it in maybe a negative way in that approaches to feed the world have sacrificed maybe some of the environmental quality. Not maybe, it has sacrificed the environmental quality that we can enjoy. And so the question is, how do we find a balance in living the way we do and enjoy and for our children, but yet still provide quality in the resources around us? And so how we do that is we team up with people who study many different things, chemistry, environment, but we specifically look at the microbes. And microbes are interesting because they cycle a lot of the nutrients and they govern a lot of the ecosystem functions that keep the air clean, keep our plants growing, and they naturally are able to take care of many, many things that we can't. For example, in our bodies, we have microbes that digest our food and provide vitamins that we can't get from any other origin except for the microbial metabolism. I think it's B12 that we get from that. So we look at the lens of how do these microbes act as either a source of environmental response or function.
So taking all of that into consideration, what are some of the questions that you ask, and maybe a little bit about how you develop some of those questions, because there are lots of things that you can study. So how do you narrow it down, especially in your role as a graduate student? How do you determine where you're going to focus?
Yeah, and I think Nicole's a great a person to ask because she's a first-year graduate student coming up with her own questions. And so in graduate school, it's really special because you're trying to find a question that no one has really answered and contribute to this knowledge that isn't there. And so it's quite an experience to figure out where your curiosity lies within something that needs to be filled in. And so maybe Nicole can talk a little bit about her journey there.
Yeah, I think trying to figure out which questions to ask is kind of, it's nuanced, and I think that it really depends on, I mean, someone has to, like, pay for our research, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, other people who are going to fund these questions need to think that it's also important, and I think that kind of innately comes along with the things that we do in our lab, being in Iowa and being really focused on agriculture and agricultural practices. And I think, you know, farmers and agricultural companies are more inclined to support questions that want to figure out, I guess, what kind of impacts they're having on the environment, because people are more concerned about it today, and I think rightfully
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
And like I think a lot of people find those types of questions interesting because you can have a really large impact by, you know, finding even just like the smallest piece of knowledge mm-hmm. that could be a key piece in the puzzle to understanding what's going on in the environment.
So share with us, what does it look like in your lab? How do you actually answer these questions? What are the things that you're doing as you do research?
Great question. So an analogy that might be helpful is to think of microbes, the individual microbes, say in a soil or a water context, that there are millions of them there, but our methods treat them like a population. And we want to do a census on that population. And we need to know what their different traits are. And so what we do, and it boils down to actually the advances in sequencing technologies and our ability to identify who they are and what they're doing, is we are able to get water or soil and then grab the data that is equivalent to the traits of a census. And this could be metrics like diversity or the number of microbes that move nitrogen or the number of microbes that are pathogens in different environments. And we pair that with experimental conditions like, well, what happens if we till soil or don't till soil, or put manure on or don't put manure on, or what happens in May in a harmful algal bloom conditions, or in December when the lake's frozen? What are the microbes doing differently? So the question of this paper is, there's a conservation practice called prairie strips where we plant at the edge of a farm field prairie strips, and they're exactly what you might think they are. They're little strips of a prairie that intercept, their goal is to intercept water flow to treat it before it goes downstream. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the question would the installation of these prairie strips then help manage some of the pathogens that might come from manure application? And so the experiment here, and this figure shows us here, so you can see prairie strips in their glory in panel A here at the edge of the field. Where the experiment here, though, is to study then a little plot, or multiple plots actually, that have just a strip planted on there, and we didn't apply manure to this plot. This is our control plot, so this is our no manure strip control. And then we have the same thing, but we put manure on it, so we're gonna compare those two. And then we also have another control where we have no strip. So this would be something where no one did a conservation practice. And the question is, what's the difference with the strip? So what happens is then we put a little rainfall simulator on top of these plots, we put rain on it, and after half an hour, you can see those gray bins, imagine them downslope, and that's where we collect water. And we wanna know, in that water, are we seeing a lot of pathogens? And so if this went as planned and prairie strips did an awesome job, we would see in this water or the sediment coming off these fields lower pathogens where strips are planted. That's what we want to see. So that was the question for this student. This student is now at the USDA. And so when I talk about traits that can be measured, the census that can be measured in the microbial community, on the x-axis, you can imagine these as traits. These are things like height or gender or maybe smoking or non-smoking. If you can imagine that for the microbial population. And then we just track like the number of microbes that have those traits. And so that's just an example of how this data plays. And so what you can see here is we can compare traits in manure versus traits in water. We want to know what that looks like at its baseline, right? Because we want manure to look like water. If manure looked just like water, this experiment would already fail. So from this plot, you can see there's certain traits that are specific to manure, right? It doesn't matter if you know what they are, but there's some where the gray dots are much higher than the blue and orange dots, which are just control runoff water and sediment from non-manured plots. So if you go to the next slide, this is like a fingerprint. So if you think, you can also think of a CSI analogy here, you're forensicking. The manure fingerprint looks so different than stuff that doesn't have manure on it, right? And so if we look at the water coming off these strips, if it looks like that manure on the left, you're like, oh, the manure microbes are in the water. Bad, maybe. And maybe in where the prairie strips are installed, it looks less like that, right? And so that's what this experiment's about. And if you go to the next slide, it's actually the results of the experiment. So where are we looking at? First, we have our baseline manure fingerprint. That's on the left column, like the rainbow oranges. And where do you see that manure? We don't see it where we see strips and no manure application, right? That totally makes sense. No manure was applied, we shouldn't see a manure fingerprint. But look at the ones where the no strip and the manure, plots 7 through 9, look how that looks like the manure, right? The manure is coming off the farm field. We don't have a strip installed, and the water coming off of that looks like manure. We're seeing manure microbes come, the traits of manure microbes come off, right? Nicole, do you see that? This is the first time Nicole's seen the slides, too. So
it is, yeah.
Too. But look at the middle one. That's the one where we installed the strip, right? So the strip's been installed at the edge of the field. The water's being collected. Do we see the manure pathogens coming off? No, not really, in plots 5 and 6. In plot 4, you can argue, well, something's going on differently there. That's just field variation. That's something we're always struggling with when we do field experiments. But this is the type of stuff we're doing with the census data in the context of how we use this kind of trait characterization to get at what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So this is often the sort of design we're doing.
So how does, I mean, this is part of a scientific paper, and that's one of the ways that scientists communicate their findings and conclusions that they might make. How else does that happen? How does the information that your lab puts together get to the people that need it? Are there other ways, or is a scientific paper the only way that that happens? I mean, how do you share what you do?
Well, we do podcasts every once in a while.
Yeah, I was going to say.
A real
right.
show at the... yeah, often the students will go to conferences and present. There's different, and that's a really great experience for not just presenting the information, but about learning about different information. There's, you know, working with extension partners like you to figure out what's the best impactful communication to the different. I think it depends who you're trying to communicate to.
Sure.
Because you want to be very effective at that communication. And honestly, we're not all trained to communicate effectively to all audiences. So sometimes we need to partner with the right partner to figure out how to say things well. Mm-hmm. But from the academic research standpoint, it's often papers and conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you guys communicate to each other. Students are always chatting with each other about the issue. And that's an important, I think that is diminished because we don't get any credit for how much you guys talk to each other and how impactful that is for your learning.
Right. So how, you know, how, what does that look like in a lab group like yours? What does that communication look like? Does it take the form of meetings, or is it mostly informal? Or how do you structure that so that you make sure that everybody knows what's happening, at least to the extent they need to for their own project?
Nicole, how do you communicate with the team?
Yeah, I think we do have, like, formal lab meetings where I think everyone gets a chance to present their work, and I think that's when everyone really gets caught up to speed, and like everyone knows what everyone's doing in those meetings. But I think where the real work comes down is like when we're really struggling and we're like, hey, have you done this before, or like, do you have any suggestions for me? I think that's when like the best collaboration actually takes place, is when you like partner one-on-one with someone else in the lab and I guess really get to use their expertise to build on your own.
So Adina, within your lab, everyone's working on a different facet of this problem with water quality. So, Nicole, do you maybe want to share about what you're working on and how it fits into the big picture?
Yeah, so Adina talked a lot about, you know, sequencing efforts, and there has been a lot done when it comes to plant microbiome and how not only bacteria but fungi can also impact the, I guess, plant growth and how they acquire nutrients or how they respond to abiotic stressors. And you can answer some of those questions by sequencing, but I think if you want to get into applications for the field, you have to be able to grow those in the lab. And so my project kind of looks at a set of isolates from a specific plant and how those might affect how it grows. This is important, I guess, and kind of goes back to the overarching questions in our lab, because if we can figure out a way to, I guess, make these bacteria work for the plant, we can reduce the amount of, I guess, chemical inputs or herbicides or things that can end up in our water and affect water quality downstream. So.
So we appreciate the conversation today. Any words of advice for our audience here? We're looking at kindergarten through 12th graders, potentially. What advice do you have for them becoming scientists, working as a scientist, and maybe eventually ending up here at Iowa State?
You want to go first?
Yeah, I think just to be curious, remain curious, and don't be afraid of maybe asking the wrong questions, because we all do at some point, and it'll lead you to the right one. So
yeah, you should eat your vegetables. There's research about how it affects your microbiome, especially broccoli is good for you, or any vegetable that looks like a tree, Brussels sprouts also. But I think maybe my piece of advice, and I talk a lot about this with my students and also my children, is the idea of failure and what it means.
Mm-hmm.
To solve a hard problem, you have to fail. And so you have to figure out how to be resilient beyond that failure. So you've got to be able to fail, but be okay with it. And,
yep.
And that's really mm-hmm. something that I find that's really difficult, especially for kids and adults, but especially for kids, because you're always driven to be successful.
Right. Right.
So it's kind of different
yeah.
in the research space.
Well, and failure can be a form of success.
It has to
right?
be. Mm-hmm. It has to be to solve problems.
Right. Right.
So.
No, excellent advice. Excellent. Yeah. Well, we want to thank both of you for being here. Adina and Nicole, thanks for joining us for this episode of Destination Biotech. Matt, thank you for being here as always.
I'm always happy to be here.
He is always happy to be here. Next time, we'll be joined by Dr. Jean Serb, who will talk about her research in adaptation and evolution. We hope to see you then. As always, remember that resources and curriculum materials can be found on our website, and we'll post the link and a QR code to that here in just a second. So thanks for joining us for our third episode. Have a good day.